Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 16th, 2011. First item on the agenda is Senate File 755. Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Welcome, everybody. Senate File 755 is a reciprocal agreement with the federal and state governments looking at administratively offsetting taxes and debts that are owed on both levels. Under this bill, the state will enter into a reciprocal agreement with the federal government to participate in their Treasury Offset Program, otherwise called TOP. And this bill allows the state to offset tax refunds or vendor contract payments for the collection of state-owed debts. So in other words, if someone owes the state money, but they're getting a refund in some form from the federal government, this is a way to capture that revenue and make sure that the state of Minnesota gets paid for what they are owed. By participating in this federal state offset program, the state will have the ability to offset amounts owed to the state against hundreds of thousands of federal non-tax, non-benefit payments every week. Examples of these tax collection categories would include tax liabilities that are owed to Minnesota, such as withholding sales use taxes, S-type corporations, LLCs, partnerships, organizations like that, and non-tax liabilities like agency-related fines, DNR, environment, fees for things like tire fees, diesel, etc., those types of fees that are owed. And examples of the offset would be income tax refunds, vendor payments, and those types of things that people are receiving from the federal government. In many cases, these organizations have left the state of Minnesota, which really limits our ability to capture that revenue that is owed in the state of Minnesota. The projected recapture in Minnesota would be about $20.8 million the first year and $15.8 million per year thereafter. There are six states that have successfully implemented this recapture since 2007, including Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Kentucky, Wisconsin, and West Virginia. And Minnesota, with our Department of Revenue, has worked on these areas also. Today I am joined by Jim Girard, who will give expert testimony regarding this recapture program.
Before you move forward, I'd like to let the record show that we do have a quorum today. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Jim Girard. I'm with Cook Girard Associates, and I'm representing Deloitte Consulting today. I think Senator Lilly gave a very good background on what the program would do. It is just another way to collect delinquent debt owed to the state by offsetting federal payments made to the debtor. Minnesota Department of Revenue does a really good job of collecting debts already for the state. And they do a good job. They have a very sophisticated debt collection program that they also collect. They collect debts for other agencies in the state. So this would just give them another tool in the toolbox to be able to collect debts that are harder to get to. And I think, as Senator Lilly said, the big advantage here would be the ability to offset federal payments. And the state already does offsets on tax payments with the federal government and I believe with the state of Wisconsin. So this would just be an addition to what is already done, but it does require legislation to allow the state of Minnesota to do it. The federal government originally put in place the mechanism to do this in 1996. It was signed into law by President Clinton.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy of the bill. I'm sorry, Mr. Girard. I don't have a copy of the bill.
We'll get one to you, Senator Goodwin. Proceed.
So the state already does offsets on tax liabilities with the federal government, both to the state and to the federal government. This would allow the offset against contractor payments for people that have already left the state of Minnesota. It's difficult for the state to get to those individuals or companies. But if a payment is being made, a vendor payment is being made from the federal government to that contractor or individual, that payment that could then be offset against state taxes or offset against other state debts that would be owed that Senator Lilly talked about. Maybe one of the most important parts is before there is protection for the debtor, before an offset occurs, the debtor would have to, first of all, the debt would have to be over 90 days old. The debtor would be informed by certified mail that the offset would be done. It would be 60, they would have 60 days to make good on that. In Maryland, when this program started, many of the debtors paid up before the deadline. That was never counted in the $20 million that Maryland collected in the first year. So there's no way to really know how much money that brought in, but there was a significant amount of money paid up by people and companies that would have had the offset happen. As I said, there's a certified letter, and that would occur prior to the debt being collected. I think the program is an opportunity for the state of Minnesota to collect money that they probably don't have much chance of getting under the current system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Any questions? I will stand for questions.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerard, so this is from basically a contractor that owes?
It.
Mr. Jerk.
Owes who money? A contractor that owes who money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Goodwin, it could be a contractor that owes the state of Minnesota either a tax debt or a fine or a fee or something that they hadn't paid to the state of Minnesota. It would be, and it could be an individual, but it would be a debt to the state of Minnesota.
And Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gerard, and who are you lobbying on behalf of to get this legislation? Deloitte, did you say?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, yes, I'm here on behalf of Deloitte. Deloitte instituted the program in Maryland.
And so, Mr. Chair, why is Deloitte interested in this? What do they have to gain? I guess I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, Gerard. Senator Goodwin, they would provide the software to the state of Minnesota that would allow this to
thank you.
Make this work.
Do we have any testifiers?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Gazelka,
I'm
sorry.
I do have one question. I didn't see a fiscal note. Are we estimating? I didn't hear. By the way, I was late because I spilled about an inch of chili all over myself. So
how was the chili?
Good.
Other than that, it was pretty good. But I didn't hear if there was an estimated savings or not to the state.
Senator Lilly.
Is there
fiscal note?
Yes.
Excuse me. Kevin, would you help us with that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. There's been a fiscal note request, but it hasn't been completed yet, so we don't have an estimate of the revenue that the Department of Revenue feels we could bring in.
Senator Lilly, do you have estimates that were provided to you?
We actually do, and Senator Gazelka, I did mention it in the beginning, but perhaps if Senator Perry were to bring his chili here for all of us to enjoy, we would all be here on time. the estimate currently is at about $20.8 million the first year and $15.8 million every year thereafter.
All right. I think the commissioner is here. Would you like to respond?
Chair, members, my name is Dan Solomone. I'm acting commissioner of the Department of Revenue and try to help you evaluate this particular bill. First, I'd like to thank the committee for its interest in our debt collection program. We got off the block fairly early in our work on this, and we have a lot to share with you. And if time permits, I'll have you talk to some of our experts on debt collection. So we do appreciate the opportunity to talk about this and appreciate the interest that Senator Lilly and Jim Gerard have expressed. I'd like to share some concerns with you, though, that while we are very grateful to have a chance to talk about our programs, I have some concerns. As you know, we have done a lot of tax compliance work in the Department of Revenue, and I have to think at some point there's a finite well of compliance revenue that is out there. And as we talk about different strategies to collect revenues for the state of Minnesota, we need to be cognizant of the fact that different bills might have different effects, and there'd be sort of a stacking order. So if you get one bill passed, you score it, and theoretically at least, it reduces the amount that's available to collect with other strategies. I'm also concerned about budget cuts that have been proposed, and I know we're far from having finalized those, but we do have some unknown there with regard to what the agency will have to do ultimately to comply with the mandated budget cuts that are most certainly going to be coming down. And finally, I would say that because we have been doing much work in this area of debt collection, I'm concerned about us spending paying more than once for the work that we want to do here. So we've already invested a lot in our program. The success of our program depends on the completion of our integrated tax program, in which we are in the very final phase of that. And we are also concerned about the there's sort of a parallel program that is going on in the in MMB as to the installation of what they call the SWIFT program. This is basically the new statewide accounting system. That is still sort of out there, and they're also moving toward the final phases of that project. So there's a lot of uncertainty with these various programs and other items that I mentioned that cause us to at least be a little cautious about what we do here. And I know the committee will be very careful with that. With that, I think I would ask our, I don't know your title, actually. you know that you've heard from Terry Steinblock, our yes. Director for Collections Operation. This is Robin Dwyer, who is her assistant, and she is very knowledgeable about the debt program.
Please state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Robin Dwyer, D-W-Y-E-R, and I'm the director of the Collection Division at the Department of Revenue.
All right. Thank you. Proceed.
All right. I believe that you do have a handout, because what I'd like to do is share with the committee some information on the federal offset processes that we already have in place, as well as some of the options for expansion of those programs as part of our integrated tax system, which is the Gentex tax system. So you all have a handout, correct?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. What this talks about is some of the programs that we have in place and the revenue generated in those programs. So if I could have you turn to the piece that says current reciprocal agreements. Right now, we do do a Fed offset match, which is with the Treasury, where we match against federal income tax refunds for debts owed to Minnesota for income taxes. And we have been doing this for quite some time. So we already have a mechanism in place to work with the Treasury Department. Since fiscal year of 2003, we've brought in over $41 million on this program. The Treasury Department does charge a fee, and right now that fee is $22, and the taxpayer is charged that fee for that offset. So there are no costs at this point for this program. And we do have this set up right now in our Gentex system. The second piece is the state to the federal offset. And we've been doing this just for a few years. Well, actually, February of 2010. So now we, if the federal government has a taxpayer that owes money and they send their names to us and we have a state income tax refund, we will send those monies to the IRS. And then we receive $20 fee for each one of those offsets. So since February of 2010, we brought in $118,000. We also work with Wisconsin, so we started this March of 2009, and we collect for Wisconsin, and they in turn collect for us. We get $15 for every refund that we send to Wisconsin. So right now, we've collected a little over $156,000 just on those fees from Wisconsin, and we do the same for them. If you turn the page over, you're going to see the optional reciprocal agreements, and these are the things that we want to do in the future. We do have a couple pieces that we need to get in place before we can make this be a smooth transition. Most of you are aware that we're working with the implemented integrated tax system. Well, I'm sure you all are aware of that. Our last rollout, which will happen in December of this year, will bring over all our other agency debt. So we collect for other state agencies. Right now, they're in our old system. They will be brought into Gentex December 12th of 2011. So we need to wait for that piece in order to fully implement this piece. We also need SWIFT to come on board, and I believe that is July of this year. So those are a couple things that we need to make some of these things happen. We not only want to do the federal to state offset for non-tax debts, which is what we're talking about today, and I just want to note that when the federal government sends us the debts, we do the match against our tax refunds. However, when we send our debts to the Treasury Department, we don't get their income tax refunds. We get vendor payments and contractor payments. So it's a little different than what we're doing today. Then we also want to work on the state to federal offsets for other Treasury debts. And there's an example of that. And then we also want to expand some of our state-to-state offsets, and this is with Wisconsin. We also want to work with them to capture refunds for other agency debts or our non-tax debts, and the same on their end. However, they need some legislation in order to make that happen. So that's what our future, that's what we're planning to do.
Thank you. Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to point out, I talked to, in response to, as a follow-up, a couple of comments that Senator Goodwin had. I'd actually talked to Senator Lilly beforehand about some of the things, and this is permissive language. This is not a requirement. It's simply permissive. And the other point I wanted to make is, although Deloitte brought this to our attention, there's no requirement in the language that says Deloitte has to do this. There's no directive. You know, there's a pool of eligible companies that could do this, go through the RFP process. You know, we just appreciate Deloitte bringing this to our attention, to Senator Lilly's attention, though there's no language requiring them or anyone else. I just wanted to point that out.
Commissioner Solomone, I don't think anyone thinks that the Department of Revenue can't do this. From what I'm hearing is, you're working towards the system to do this. Would you agree that this, whether if this were to go through and pass, this would give you another tool in your toolkit if you wanted to ramp up something quicker while you're establishing what you ultimately will be doing, and you fully know the constraints of the budget and what might be coming your way? This would just give you another tool to ramp up and use that tool while you're getting all, for better words, your ducks in a row with the new system.
Mr. Chair, that's how I would interpret what I'm hearing, the permissive nature of this. It gives us the flexibility to decide where we want to put our resource and what might be most beneficial to the state. I think that's an accurate assessment, and that's how we would view this.
All right. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Salamone, I'm wondering if you know what this Deloitte system would cost the state, and I assume that a lot of the work would be done out of state by Deloitte at their national headquarters, and if not, correct me if I'm wrong, but what the actual cost would be, not only the beginning startup cost, but the ongoing cost. I've seen these kinds of things that the state has done before, and it's ended up costing outrageous amounts of money. And so can you, do you know the answers to that, or do I have to ask Mr. Girard those questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin may have to do both. I did have the benefit of sitting in on one presentation from Deloitte. It was a teleconference call. And I have some pieces of information. I can't say that I've memorized all the data. I do recall that there was a sort of upfront fee of about $3 million that we would have to pay, I think, to get into the program. And as Terry, as Robin mentioned, there are differences in fees that would be assessed to the taxpayer. But in fairness to Deloitte, I think it might be a good idea to have Jim perhaps to elaborate on that.
Mr. Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, there would be no upfront cost to the state for this program. It's already been, the program's been built. There would be a nominal fee to the debtor when the debt is collected. That's how the system would be paid for.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Would this be, this would be work then, I would assume that would be done outside of the state with Deloitte. And what's the nominal fee? I mean, there's got to be something, it's got to be fairly lucrative if they would hire a lobbyist to come down here and try to promote this. That's what I'm trying to find out. How much is it going to cost the state?
Mr.
Chair, Senator Goodwin, it would not cost the state anything. It would be a fee against the debtor when it's collected. It would be added on. If it's $1,000 that's collected from the federal government, there would be a fee added on to that. It's not a huge fee, but there would be a fee. That's how Deloitte would be paid. The system is already built and could be installed in Minnesota. It would be installed at the Department of Revenue.
Senator
wow.
Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, and members, I think it's important that we have the conversation about Deloitte and what they are bringing to the table and how they are participating in this potential opportunity. At the same time, I think the real conversation that's before us is this a good idea to do something like this, to be working in this area? And are there areas of law that this committee can assist the Department of Revenue in what they are working towards accomplishing? And I believe that there are areas that we are being asked to work together on, and this feels to me like one of those steps towards trying to make sure that we have the opportunity to capture the revenues that are sitting out there that we don't necessarily have the tools in place today to collect those revenues. So how we get across the threshold, I think that is an area that we will want to talk about, that we need to figure out. But there's nothing in the bill today that names a vendor, that names a direction that we're going. To me, that's a future conversation. It is one of the opportunities or one of the ways that this can be accomplished. So that is something that could come down the road. I'm not at all trying to hide that. At the same time, I think I would like to have more of a cooperative conversation about how are we collecting our revenues? Are there opportunities to collect some that may be missing? And that, to me, is what we're trying to accomplish with this bill.
Senator
Goodwin.
Just one additional comment. So this would mean that if this was done by Deloitte or any other vendor, that they would have access to private data on Minnesota taxpayers or Minnesota vendors or people of the state that would normally, where that data would be absolutely protected under data privacy, but we would be giving that data to a private company. Is that correct?
Senator Lilly?
Mr. Chair, I think that's probably a fair understanding, but I look at this list again. There are six states who are currently using these types of services, and I'm sure there are a myriad of other states who are not on this list but who are doing similar types of things. And the protections are in place to protect the data that is there. The state of Minnesota protects our data. I would have to venture that systems would be put in place to protect our residents, protect their data in this case also.
Well,
Mr.
Chair,
Girard?
That's very I would
Goodwin,
like to ask for a roll call.
Senator Goodwin?
I would like
Excuse
to ask
me.
For a roll call.
Excuse me. First, Mr. Girard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, the Department of Revenue would have control over the information. This is their information. They would have control over it. Deloitte puts the system in place. Deloitte has a huge presence in the state of Minnesota. Downtown Minneapolis, there's a many, many offices. Deloitte does a lot of work in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Any further discussion? Senate File 755 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is Senate File 811. Senator Thompson. Welcome, Senator Thompson. Do I understand that you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be here today. And I would like to offer the A1 amendment, which I believe is being passed out right now. It simply adds a fourth subdivision to the bill, which discusses managerial policy and how the commissioner's duties and responsibilities will be carried out. And that's what I've got for you, that one option.
Senator Thompson moves the A1 amendment.
Yes.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. This bill is relatively simple. The purpose of the bill is to ask the Commissioner of Management and Budget to require the Commissioner of Management and Budget to request proposals for a contract to provide dependent eligibility verification on health plans here in the state. As you'll see as you look over the bill for state-paid hospital, medical, and dental benefits. Put very simply, this is an attempt to get at, in many cases, fraud. And what we're trying to find out is whether or not there are employees of the state that are on medical hospitalization, dental plans, those kinds of things that have dependents listed that are not, in fact, dependents. So it could be as extreme as someone who puts the neighbor kid on their plan, uses a false name, something along those lines, or in some cases uses the correct name. It could be, I suppose, theoretically at least, an unintentional inclusion of a dependent that ought not be a dependent. So this bill simply directs the Commissioner of Management and Budget to go out and request proposals to do an audit. And once the initial audit is done, there will be an ongoing process of auditing to make certain that, we get those people off the state health system that are not eligible to be there. And then the commissioner will be required to enter into a contract for services by a certain date that will be determined as we go through the process. And I would also note that this bill also requires that the contract with any vendor require a performance-based component to be looked at so that the contractor would be looking at receiving compensation based on a percentage of savings. And really, Mr. Chair, it's that simple. In summary, we have some reason to believe there are people that are listed as dependents in state health plans that are not, in fact, dependents and should therefore not be allowed to remain on the system. We're directing the commissioner to go out, hire a company to take a look at that, get paid based upon performance, percentage of savings, and try to make sure that this doesn't continue to go on. And we do have an audit from the state that indicates that we'd have roughly in year one about $13,300,000+ in savings, and it goes up from there. But I would like to point out for clarification that only approximately one-third of that savings, so in the range of $4.5 million, would go to the general fund, two-thirds to the other funds that are used to provide these benefits. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Morocco, are you here? You would like to address that? Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I oversee the state's Employee Group Insurance Program.
Welcome, and please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I was just asked to provide a couple comments, and I think the senator had laid out the potential savings, I think, quite well. It's pretty straightforward. Just a couple caveats I would like to mention. We're still in the process of generating the fiscal note. It was really a courtesy to the committee to try and prepare something ahead of that, just so that you had a rough estimate. And again, I think the senator laid that out well. A couple components that might make the savings less than what we have provided initially. First of all, dependent eligibility has become more straightforward than in the past. As a result of PPACA, the health care reform that passed at the federal level, there is no longer a requirement for student eligibility in order to have coverage. You essentially can cover dependents up until age 26, regardless of student status. That was one area that was particularly challenging, I think, for health plans and administrators to, on a quarter-by-quarter basis, ensure that these dependents were going to school, and a potential area for misrepresentation of enrollment. That has been simplified, and so there is a lot of information about the potential range of savings, and but whether those are still valid or not is something that we're trying to sort out right now at MMB. But I think some of the preliminary numbers, at least at this point, are fine. Before making the next statement, I do want to apologize to the senator. I was stalking him before the hearing. I hope that this will be a friendly suggestion we certainly understand the value of a dependent audit, the potential that's out there, but really would prefer as the administrators of the program to have the flexibility to do it in a manner that's best suited for the program. Certainly, there are a lot of great vendors out there that can do this for us. There are a lot of other potential changes that may be coming to CGIP, and there may be ways for us to either do some of it in-house, combine it with some other activity, perhaps outsource portions of it, do some of it in-house, and would just prefer to have that flexibility to do that. But certainly, what we're going to cost out is exactly as the senator had laid out, and I think the goal here is to have an aggressive document-seeking verification process, and that's how we are going to fiscal note it with that in mind. Certainly, there are more passive ways. You can use the honor system. Those systems tend to, generate maybe 2% savings, and I think what the senator is trying to get at is, we really want to make sure that these people are providing merit certificates. We want to see birth certificates. We really want to see the solid documentation, and that's certainly how we would fiscal note it and how we would approach it. But we would just prefer to have the flexibility that if we want to outsource parts of it or combine it with other activity, that there would be the opportunity to do so. But I'd be happy to work with the senator offline if that's a better way to do it. Or
Mr. Chair, I don't
Senator
know.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was it your intent to lay this over? Or
yes, it was.
Or
Senator.
To take a vote? I would think that would not be inconsistent with me continuing discussions and seeing if there's some kind of a compromise we could come to. I guess my thought would be a part of the reason we're looking for some outside help is that apparently this isn't being done as aggressively as it could be right now, but I never preclude a discussion, and we didn't have a chance to talk, so I'd be happy to do that.
All right. Senator Goodwin.
Quick question, Mr. Chair, and I forgot our guest.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Morocco. Would doing this outside of the department have an impact on data privacy? I mean, would private data, again, have to be given to a private firm in order for them to be able to make these determinations?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it really would, it would, but it would depend on who we would consult with. We currently do that today. So in order for you to be enrolled in the health plan, we are sending information to Blue Cross Health Partners and Preferred One as an agent of our program. We are allowed and they are allowed to manage a portion of that data. If they, as an example, were to do the audit, there would be no additional information sent out. Obviously, if we do the audit, none. If we go to a separate source, if it's like a Mercer or a Deloitte or an Aon or something like that, then that it would be a new entity that would be accessing our data. We would be providing data, but it would be in the same realm as or in the same sense that we currently do it as part of our day-to-day administration.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Thompson. I apologize if I wasn't listening with both of my ears, but you indicated there's some sense of the order of magnitude of this problem from an audit that's already been conducted? Did I hear that correctly? Do we have a sense of this problem?
Actually,
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble. Mr. Morocco could probably address that more clearly than I can. If I understood him correctly, there's been an initial analysis done, but some factors have changed, such as the eligibility age going up, that may change these numbers, so he doesn't know that these numbers are absolutely solid, but this is the best estimate he has right now. Is that a fair representation?
Mr. Morocco.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator, really I wouldn't say we've done an audit of our program. We're simply taking the information, likely the same that's available to all of you. We're seeing anywhere between 2 to 15% potential savings in any given program, and really starting there. Certainly there's things that we do to try and to, you know, manage dependent eligibility, but I wouldn't call it an audit on our program, just simply taking standard industry results, assuming that we would be a typical part of the industry and could achieve perhaps that range of savings, and then applying what those dollars might mean in our group.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And is this an agency initiative?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I wouldn't define it as an agency initiative. I'm just simply offering some information for the committee as they consider this policy.
Mr. Morocco, could I ask, would you consider this also another tool in your toolkit as you look, as we heard from the commissioner, that it's just another avenue for you to really scrutinize the dollars that the taxpayers have and that you're working with?
Mr. Chair, certainly it's a tool. It becomes a mandatory tool. So, in that sense, it's a tool we will always use. I'm not in necessarily, agreement or disagreement with that from a policy perspective, but certainly it offers us an opportunity to do dependent verification. We have, as a result of some of the changes to dependent definitions, we actually have been working for about the last year and a half with our Department of Commerce on state law regarding dependent eligibility, as well as reacting to the changes at the federal level. So we actually have done a fair amount of at least cleanup and streamlining of how we define dependents and making that as clear as we can to our members. This would sort of be taking it to the next level, then actually requiring that type of documentation to prove the eligibility.
Senator Thompson, are you aware of this being done in other states?
I can't name specifically where it's done, but my understanding is some other states have experimented and used these kinds of programs, yes.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Morocco, I would like to request, if I may please, that you put together, just during the last 5 years, I would like to see the level of fraud that that you have documented, because obviously there are lots of things that we could suspect that are happening in the state that are not good, and we obviously don't have the money to review all of those things. But my presumption is Senator Thompson knows that this is a problem, and that's why he's offering this bill. And so I would like to request a 5-year kind of a record on actual fraud so that we can really see the year after year problem that you have that we're trying to correct.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres Ray, you indicated that I must know this is going on. I certainly don't. My assumption is based upon normal industry standards that there typically is an element of that that goes on, and I think one of the reasons it makes some sense to require a percentage of savings to be paid to the outside firm is so that if it turns out that we don't have a big problem, it doesn't cost us a lot, but I'm suggesting it always makes sense to look into something because we know that a percentage of people will game the system.
And Mr. Morocco, on Senator Torres Ray's request, I guess I would, if you can provide that to my committee chair, we can hand that out. But also I would be very interested to see what percentage of time and aggressiveness has been put into that portion of checking, because the outcomes would be skewed if we're only able to do a 2% of the time checking, as opposed if you have a group that's what they're focused on. Would you agree with that, Senator Torres-Ray? Because if they can't get deeper in and do more, it will somewhat skew those results. At least that's my thought.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Thompson, I apologize about my presumption. You know, there are lots of things that we could presume are not happening in the state. It's a large bureau. And whatever agency you want to review, you probably will see, you know, improper use of computer systems, improper use of time, improper use of, you know, managerial responsibilities. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could audit, absolutely. I think my question is, you know, you're trying to figure out how do you put together, a structure and fund a structure that will verify this, right? And so the presumption is that somehow we the system that is in place is actually not very good. And you select this versus others. I mean, we could talk a lot about computer usage, for instance, and say, you know, this is not a good use of computer. But you didn't make the decision on that particular system. You made a decision on this particular system. And we can ask that question right now. I mean, you don't need to ask an auditor. Mr. Morocco can tell you exactly how many, cases they have reviewed in which they have discovered that. And they know that. You don't need a company to find that out. 5 years, and you will know. You can be the company that actually, we can do that here. Correct me, Mr. Morocco, but you can bring me 5 years, and I'll tell you exactly what's going on, right? Is that correct?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, certainly we can give you some numbers in terms of what we audited. I think what's being suggested in the language is a different method of verifying dependents, which is different than what we do today. We're talking about a document-based eligibility system, which is different than most employers, but typical or one of the typical methodologies of a dependent audit, which is more of a single point in time type of audit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely. Sorry. So you have the numbers. We are arguing, or at least you know, the proposal here is that you need extra audit because there is a belief that somehow your audit is not good enough. So I would like to see your audit before I actually authorize another audit, because if this is not a big problem, you're simply auditing something that you don't need to audit. We can audit everything. Everything can be audited outside of the audit system that exists. And so I would like to see the 5-year record to see what the problem is, that it merits extra audit. That's all I'm requesting.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a oral amendment. Senator Thompson would, line 1.9, instead of shall, put may. On line 120, instead of required by, put in. And on the second page, on line 2.6, instead of must, put may. And then on 2.8, after based, insert only. Now, basically what this does is say the department can do these things. I think a lot of new members aren't aware, but there's over $1 billion worth of contracting done by the state right now. A lot of that, as I've examined that system over the years, has been hugely expensive and unnecessarily so, and not very well accounted for,
Senator
quite frankly.
Goodwin, can we have Mr. Bodern go through it real
sure,
quick, and then you
absolutely.
Can continue your oral amendment. Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman, just restating the amendment, and I think it all it works. It's consistent. On page 1, line 9, delete shall and insert may. And on page 1, line 20, delete required by and insert, might work better to say under.
Under.
And then on page 2, line 6, delete must and insert may. And on page 2, line 8, after based, insert only.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Proceed.
What this would do would basically give the department the authority to do that, allow them to take a look at what the different contracts out there are for auditing our healthcare system and who's cheating on it, which I haven't heard this one before, but I suppose there are some in any system, private or public. But at any rate, what it would do would give them the authority to do it, authorize them to certainly look at that and see what the vendors would cost. Like I was saying, there we have over about $1 billion worth of contracting done in the state, and once you start to get to understand the state system and the contracting system, you'll see that there are very little, there's very little oversight. There's many contracts that don't ever get completed, that then they have to start over with another contract. The sentence here where I put only instead of vendor, because then the vendor would not be able to charge anything except for on the amount of savings that are generated by the work. So they would have to charge based on the amount of savings and only on the amount of savings, rather than have a contract that pays them X amount of dollars plus that. So I guess I think, you know, we might be doing a little micromanaging here. I certainly don't think it's something worth looking at, Senator Thompson, and perhaps for the department to look closer at and for us to follow up with the department and see what they found out about the cost of the system and who does this kind of work and whether they have a good reputation and they can be trusted and so forth. But I don't think we should force the department to do this, especially when we don't have any evidence of wrongdoing at this point. So I think anyway, I would ask for a roll call vote on this amendment.
Roll call has been requested and granted. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, members, I would ask that you not support the suggested amendment, and Senator Goodwin used the term micromanagement. I believe I would refer to that as legislative oversight. I believe that one of the problems that we have right now is a lack of attention to what agencies are doing that we as a legislature have asked in the past to do. This in no way calls into question the credibility or the intent of any individual, Mr. Morocco, or anyone else. The point is, we are the ones that are elected and given the responsibility to oversee these things. I respectfully disagree with Senator Goodwin's premise that you don't audit something unless you have a reason to believe there's a problem. Public companies in this country, as Senator Daley could well testify to, being a CPA, are required to undergo audits, even though there's no outside audits, by the way, independent audits, even though there is no inherent suspicion of wrongdoing. It's the way we do business here in America. And if, in fact, the cost of that contract ends up exceeding the savings, then I would be the first one to join on with Senator Goodwin to get rid of it. The whole point here is to attempt to generate some savings, so I would respectfully ask members to oppose Senator Goodwin's amendment.
Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I had a question for Mr. Morocco, and I just was wondering if I heard correctly and if I could get a clarification. This is regarding the amendment.
Thank you, yes, Senator Lilly.
Did you say that that standard industry results might indicate that there could be as much as a 10 to 15% situation here? Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would say the range is probably anywhere between 2 and 15%, depending on the methodology and the type of employer population that you're auditing.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco.
Thank you.
In regard to the amendment, 2 to 15% to me feels pretty substantial. We're talking about the public's money. We're talking about a perception of what is happening with the public's money. And in this conversation that we've been having with Mr. Morocco, I don't think there's any accusation that things are wrong. I think there's a matter of measuring to find out the current situation. And in this conversation, what I'm hearing is that we have reviewed our current structure but not audited. And there's a significant difference between reviewing where we are at and auditing where we're at. There are test protocols that are in place for auditing. there's a thoroughness to it that is not there when we simply review something. So I think if we really want to get our arms around what the potential opportunity or the potential problem here might be, I believe that an audit is the proper way to review this.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are two reasons why I think this is important. One is that we have a legislative audit commission here, and they do audit state agencies. And that is a branch of the legislature, not a branch of the executive branch. So we do have auditing done. If you want a specific audit done in this area, Senator Thompson, you can ask the Legislative Audit Commission to do that audit and to find out, to audit the department and to start auditing a few of those health contracts and find out if people are cheating on this. So there is an alternative to this. In the second place, if Senator Hand's bill passes, which I assume it will, or it'll be rolled over into the bill, you won't need this anyway, because state employees and public employees, including you, won't really have health insurance, because you'll have $5,000 deductible per person. So you're not going to really have health insurance anyway. So I don't think people are going to cheat on that plan, because it's just more people that are going to have to, in the family, that are going to have to pay high deductibles. So I would say, please vote for this amendment to make this an option and not mandatory. And you definitely have the ability to get the legislative auditor to do this study, so you really know whether or not this is a problem.
Secretary, take the roll.
Senator Carlson?
No.
He basically just makes it.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Senator Lilly?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Ortman?
No.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Torres-Ray?
Yes.
Senator Weger?
Yes.
Chairman Perry?
No. With 8 no's, 4 yeas, amendment does not prevail. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I just wanted to make a brief comment. I understand the message and the premise from Senator Lilly's comment, and I agree with that. I think that those measures are important. Those measures are necessary, and many state agencies actually do use these measures. I agree with that. I think what is problematic here is that we have not heard of this problem, Senator Thompson, and I can't tell you. I don't know. I think, Mr. Morocco, I would like you to please come back to the table, because I would like to know, actually, if you can tell us, for the last year, could you tell us, have we had a problem that a state employee has actually cheated the system and claim? Do you have a record of that?
Senator Torres-Ray, I'm going to stop it there. You've already requested a 5-year report. I'm not going to go down this, and I'm going to send Senate File 811 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Morocco and Senator Thompson. Next item on the agenda will be Senate File 798, Senator Jungbauer. Welcome, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's great to be in your committee. It's a committee I know a little bit about, having served 4 years on a different iteration of the committee. So I have a great passion for some of the things you're working on, and hopefully I bring you some ideas here today. So get everything ready here. You know,
Senator Jung,
my old age, get the glasses thing ready.
Do you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I believe I have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair and members. I have not seen it. I know what it does.
I believe we were looking at moving that as an oral author's amendment.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair and members, and I would, on Senate File 798, we'll start out by moving an author's amendment. It's an oral amendment to delete Section 1 and just leave Section 2 and Section 3 in the bill. that will get the bill in the shape I'd like to start with it in this committee, I guess.
On the author's amendment, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There was a lot of consternation over Section 1, and it's much easier at this point to remove that. But as you were talking with Senator Thompson's bill and a lot of things were going back and forth about attention to detail and whether or not legislative oversight, micromanaging was going on, members, I guess I'm pretty well known for my attention to detail and trying to dig through contracts and expenses, expenditures, and things like that. And I believe you're all handed a run of state leases and a lot of our costs surrounding leases and space and even members. And I had a marked up version, and I don't know where it ended up in my file. But even you'll even find in there one cost to the Department of Ag of $400,000 for a year for a parking. And members, when you look at that, and we're in such a time as this in terms of budget, we need to look at every item and every utilization that we use in terms of the state government. And everything from leases to the space utilization, and I'll give you an idea in terms of space utilization and where I'm trying to go with having analysis of what we're doing, is if you kind of imagine somebody, and I'll just use round numbers here, somebody using 10,000 square feet today, the old-fashioned way to do office cubicles was, in general, 8x8 with higher cubicle walls, and you had your own little cube space.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Senator.
Senator,
I don't have a copy of Mr. Jungbauer or Senator Jungbauer's amendment.
It was an oral amendment.
Oh, just, thank you. Sorry.
So if you just crossed out all of Section 1, okay. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. I apologize. I wasn't clear on just crossing out Section 1. So but trying to give you a little background. Today, the way with space utilization is done in many companies is use a 6x6 cubicle. You keep the walls down low. In fact, even share some of those cubicles. Well, in the last 4 years I was on state government budget, I took tours of many of this the off-site lease space, as well as much of our space that we own, such as the PCA, the DNR, Department of Labor and Industry, and was looking at the way we utilize space, the amount of space we take up. And quite honestly, members, as we've shrunk our workforce, department managers have not shrunk their space needs. They keep thinking that someday we're going to build up our workforce again, and so we have all this unutilized space that's costing us money. And so we need to look at those sorts of things, and really that's what brings Senate File 798 to you, is my interpretation of waste of space, of looking at new layouts, and probably one of the best places I was in private industry was Medtronic at their Mounds View site. A lot of people come in and out of work, and there's actually open spaces. They don't have assigned desks necessarily, but the people that are in there work on some of these desks. And we do a lot of those things within state government where we allow people to sometimes work from home and things. We can utilize space much better. And the bottom line, so I'll try to get to the point, is we can save money. And we can save a lot of money. And, in fact, the governor identifies that just in leases alone, in what he's been looking at and his advisors are giving him, is about a 10% savings or about $12 million in the biennium in lease space alone. But if you look at further on some of these runs, members, you'll find things such as storage space. And what we're storing is extra desks, extra dividers, computers that will be outdated, things that we're probably never going to use or we're certainly never going to use in the short term, and certainly if we ever use them again, those types of items will be outdated. They should be sent to our surplus area up in Moundsview there to be sold. That storage space should be gotten rid of, so we're not spending money on that. We should be looking at parking as well. But especially, again, back to the space utilization is, again, if we can go back from 10,000 square feet and knock it down to 8,000 square feet, all that puts us in good stead with our constituents. We're actually improving productivity by putting a better workspace together, a more open workspace. And if you've been in, say, the PCA or DNR buildings, those buildings already lend themselves to that. They're very wide open. They're very a lot of sunshine, a lot of window space, like you'd be designing a new green space, only we use the wrong kind of dividers to make those spaces productive. So we have a lot of good practitioners, and we've got some great people here that work in Department of Admin, and sitting down with them, my question to them was, can you accomplish a lot of this revisioning in a year? And they said, no, we don't have enough staff. And I said, well, can you accomplish it in 3 years? And they said, well, maybe. Well, the time is right now, members, to accomplish that. And so what Section 2 really does is allows for the department to put out RFPs to get independent contractors to come in and say, you know what, we can redesign this space, we can save you that money, and we're not going to charge you for that. We're going to capture a portion of that savings in order to pay for our services. And I think that's a good thing to do, and we'll actually have Department of Admin will come up, and they've done a report on some of their lease things, and I think they came out to the same conclusion that the leases maybe won't save as many dollars, although we argue here, you know, a few million here, a few million there, it's pretty soon it's real money. But I had three commercial real estate companies look at what the governor's thoughts were and what my thoughts were, and they thought we'd save probably in excess of $20 million on leases. But they thought we could be as high as $40 million in getting rid of some of the storage space and two commercial real estate places looked at the $400,000 a year for a parking space, and they said, Senator, for that, you can buy a ramp pretty darn soon and pay for it. And if that's what we're going to need, we ought to be owning it instead of paying it. And we also have other things where we rob Peter to pay Paul, and maybe admin can say how we do that. We charge back different organizations within the government, and I don't know how they keep track of that. We are getting better. I have to say from that 4 years, we actually, even when I got here 4 years ago in this committee, Mr. Chair, I'd like you to know that even admin and a lot of people didn't know what space we had open, and other departments didn't know what kind of spaces they had extra, what kind of desks they had extra, what kind of space utilization they needed. We're getting better in terms of logging that, so we're getting there. But I think this bill kind of brings us over the top and says, you know, in order to get this done quick, we can bring in outside people. And members, if they don't see a savings, we risk nothing. They will not respond to the RFP. If they see a savings, they'll respond. We'll have the ability to accept that RFP and move on. But it really is very permissive in allowing us to do something that isn't there today and something where somebody else will come in and say, I see a way that my business can come in and help the state save money and make a little bit of money, and it's that simple.
I understand we have testifiers here that we'd like to get through. Testifiers in favor of this file? Testifiers?
I have one testifier that I brought in, and I don't know where admin actually stands in terms of in favor of or against, but I think it's a good thing to have people working with them, so they will be testifying as well. So,
please state your name.
Jim Damiani.
Thank you for appearing. You may proceed.
I'm a commercial realtor. I have practiced commercial real estate for the past 24 years. I specialize in office leasing and sales. I've been giving some information to Senator Jungbauer just on relates to the market today. Market conditions are favorable for tenants today. The one thing on the bill that I'm in favor of, obviously, is outsourcing. Not only real estate, but architectural. As Senator Jungbauer was talking about, getting more efficient with the layouts and things like that. That's where you could save, I think, a lot of money, as well as the lease rates. Your staff does a great job, I think, admin-wise, on the real estate, on what they can do, knowing what they know about the market. But I think outsourcing, they'll know a little more about what deals are happening, especially it's so fluid today. The way deals are happening, every landlord's different, and it changes almost weekly just with the market. For instance, if I was working for the state as a state employee on the real estate, I think I could do a good job for about a month, and then I'd be out of touch a little bit with what deals are happening because they change so often. So you're working somewhat in a vacuum, in my opinion, and if you outsource to, you know, one, two, three different commercial real estate experts, they'd be able to utilize that and not cut any of their staff, maybe even grow the staff a little bit because there'd be some funds with the savings. And I think it's prudent today to utilize the expertise of the private industry.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if you saw this report, and I realize this is February 2010. If you take a quick look at that, how close do you think we are to those average market rental rates now? I know that we're dramatically lower, but I just want somebody else to confirm that.
Mr. Damiani.
You know, this is my first time seeing this. I'd really have to do some research. We have a full research staff at Welsh Companies that we could dig into this for you and get some answers back to you just by looking at this, just numbers on a page to me without doing some research. I'd feel uncomfortable stating it's a good deal or not a good deal by looking at these numbers.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anybody that wants to testify in the negative? Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Howard Rostin. The last name is spelled R-O-S-T-O-N. I'm an attorney in the state here, licensed to practice law. I'm here on behalf of BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association. I have a specific concern as an attorney who represents building owners in lease negotiations, purchase, financing, and a variety of real estate-related matters. I have a specific concern about Section 2, Subdivision 1, Subpart 1, and the reference to canceling the lease. Certainly, if a commercial lease is negotiated and provides for a termination or cancellation right as an arm's-length negotiation in the lease itself, then the parties have whatever contractual rights there are, and I'm not here to argue about that. But to the extent this section could be construed as providing a cancellation right that does not already exist in the arm's length negotiated contract, then I think the building owners, particularly in St. Paul, that have a lot of government tenants, but elsewhere in the state, would have some concerns. And so I would ask that this provision be clarified to make it clear that it does not provide for any cancellation right as a matter of statute that does not already exist in a negotiated lease between the parties.
Thank you. Mr. Bodden, could you weigh in on this, please?
Mr. Chairman, you could certainly clarify it. I think it's intended to work that way since that sentence says the vendor must identify the leases where the commissioner would be able to do that. Presumably, the commissioner would only be able to do that with existing authority. But you can certainly add language on page 2, line 26. After by, you could insert using previously existing authority. And then I think you need to delete renegotiating. So it's a previously existing authority to renegotiate the lease, and we'll have to delete canceling and insert cancel.
Senator Jungbauer.
Using previously existing authority.
Before he answered, Senator, Mr. Bodden, could you just go through that one more time for us?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 26, after by, or excuse me, on page 2, line 26, delete renegotiating and insert using previously existing authority to renegotiate. And then on page 2, line 27, delete canceling. So the new sentence would read The vendor must identify leases where the commissioner can reduce lease expenditures by using previously existing authority to renegotiate the lease or cancel the lease. And I suppose for good measure, we should delete entering and insert enter. Actually, entering will work there, and entering into a new lease at a lower rate.
So your thoughts, Senator Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair, members, well, I'm not certain. I mean, the authority part makes sense because I think the authority is granted by the contractual agreement and statute. The way our contracts are written today, we've got very specific exclusions for opting out of or canceling contracts. So I think that works. You were,
Mr. Rostin, and realize this is technical in nature, and we will be laying this bill over, but please proceed. Absolutely. Mr. Rostin.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would request that it refer to previously existing contractual rights as opposed to previously existing authority. If it's going to be laid over, I'd be happy to help in whatever way I can to clarify the terms.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Jungbauer,
I think I'd be happy to work on that, but I believe that based on statute, we would have to talk about authority versus the contractual rights because I think they exist in a separate type of situation.
Thank you, Senator Dibble.
On that, I was just reading Mr. Wozlowski's sheet here, and if you look at termination provision on the second page, the top of the right-hand column, 16B24 sub 6 is written out here, and it says the commissioner may lease land or premises for up to 10 years subject to cancellation upon 30 days written notice by the state for any reason except lease of other non-state owned land or premise for the same use. So, you know, we could talk about contracts or authority, but it is written into statute. You know.
Sure. Mr. Wasilowski, do you want to weigh in on this for admin?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wasilowski. I'm the director of Real Estate and Construction Services, and I oversee the leasing activities for the state of Minnesota. With respect to the termination provision, Senator Dibble is correct. There's an existing statute that dictates our lease provision, and at this point, we don't see any have any concerns from our standpoint with the existing law. We think it does a nice job of balancing, giving the state flexibility as programs change, as budgets change, to be able to reduce our space likewise. But it also gives us negotiating leverage with our landlords. This is probably readily apparent to everybody, but I'll mention it. If we make a longer-term commitment to a landlord for space, we get better rates. That really is, we actually had been receiving some strong feedback already on the proposed language in the bill regarding, that was the section one of the bill, where we were in the middle of negotiations and they were saying, no, we're stopping negotiations till we get that, find out what's happening with that provision, because they were viewing that as taking us into an annual lease situation versus a longer term deal.
All right. Hearing no further discussion, Senate File 798 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Wait a minute. They would like to discuss it, Mr. Chair. Plus, I have a language question on here that I'm not quite sure
I didn't see
about.
Your hand come up.
No, no, it wasn't. He was trying to get your attention.
Oh, excuse me. I thought you were all done. You had more, Mr. Wasilowski?
Mr. Chair, I certainly do, if the committee will.
Matt, a couple questions.
Oh, okay. Why don't you go, because I see Senator Goodwin and Senator Dibble have a couple more questions. So if you want to.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'll probably start with where we agree with Senator Youngbaron. And I want to appreciate we had a good meeting beforehand. He shared his proposed bill with us, and we had a good dialogue on our different perspectives on where we see the opportunity to save money around the state's real estate. Where we agree is around space utilization, that if we want to save money around our real estate, the greatest opportunity is to shrink our building, our portfolio. It's to reduce our space. And Senator Youngbaron was mentioning Medtronic. We had a similar experience with General Mills, where they shared a space that they call their flexible work environment, but it's really around hoteling, shared office space concepts. And even if you didn't have program changes, if you had the same program, you can, from what they were able to do, they demonstrate they have a more productive work environment by actually reducing their square footage simply through hoteling and shared space concepts. So agree fully with Senator Youngbaron on that's an area that we should be aggressively looking at on an enterprise level. Where we, I guess, differ is on the rental rates and the results that we're getting through our professional in-house staff. We do have dedicated staff that it's 2.5 people plus a supervisor, so it's a very small staff, but they were hired for their expertise in negotiating leases. That is their full-time job, and that's different than many organizations where maybe support staff person is left with the job of negotiating leases. These are folks that really know what they're doing. They have expertise in negotiations and in lease administration. And we obviously do self-assessments on how we doing in negotiating leases. And self-assessments have obviously an inherent bias in that process. And so we did engage the University of St. Thomas to do an independent review of, and I hadn't worked with their real estate group before, but we picked up the phone, we talked to them, we said, could you come in and take a look at our leases and give us an objective third-party review and tell us how we doing
relative to the market. And they came back in, and they only reviewed, they reviewed 13 leases. They picked them. We didn't have any input on what leases they picked. They came back and said that in every case, we were either at or below market rates in at the time those leases were executed. I think one of the points Senator Youngbauer was making with us was, okay, we're in a, we have a market opportunity here. We're at a historical low point in the market. We have a good opportunity for renegotiating leases. And part of what we provided in the handout was, we are doing that. We are aggressively. It's not just when leases expire that we go after to renegotiate leases. It's also when we could negotiate a 10-year lease and we're 5 years into that. And obviously market conditions are constantly changing. That's an opportunity for us to, again, go back to those landlords. And in that situation, we do have to give something, and what we typically end up giving is a longer-term commitment. So we go out to extend that five-year lease out to 10 years, and that's where we get are able to get rates that reflect the current market rates. Right. So, again, we would say that we don't see the lease negotiations. We feel we have the capacity to do that. We feel we're doing it well today. And it really, again, we see the opportunity around space utilization. And the comment around we have one person that works on space program. We don't have the capacity to do what Senator Youngbauer is suggesting. We would have to go out with an RFP for architectural services to have people take a look at our space. In our lease facilities, we can ask our landlords to do that for us. In our own facilities, we would have to hire a consultant to help us do that. Just in closing, we're in the process of updating our space standards. They're going to be done within the next few weeks, and they're going to incorporate those concepts around hoteling and shared space, and we're going to roll that out to state agencies and implement that across the enterprise. But we are going to need help to capture that opportunity around space utilization.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Oh, Mr. Chair, this is just a question on the – I've got a question on the bill on page 3.11. I'm trying to figure out what clause one is, especially in light of – because it says that till the fiscal year specified in clause one. What is – maybe Mr. Bodern can tell me what clause one is.
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, Clause 1 refers to the language you see beginning on line 3.4, and that's an effort to segregate the first full fiscal year where you'd see cost savings, and that may depend on how the project unfolds. So this is simply a cross-reference to that same fiscal year.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions for Senator Jungbauer. On the request for proposals, I'm just wondering, on line 2.21, you have this 60-day deadline to get the RFPs out the door. I'm just wondering about the magic of the 60 days after the bill goes into effect. Just wondering why you wrote the bill in that manner.
Senator Jungbauer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble. I come from the private world, and I've made this very clear when we're talking about permits or anything else. If you can't figure it out in 60 days or 90 days, you can't figure it out. So mm-hmm. I'm always kind of pushing people to get something done, because otherwise it always gets put on the back burner.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Senator thank you. Dibble?
So then I'm assuming then your answer would be the same on line 2.34, the within 10 days after accepting the proposal, the contract will be entered.
Senator Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. And again, I relate that back to our current budget. Members, I've been here 8 years. We've basically been in a deficit the whole 8 years. We need to start changing things. We need to change it now. And to the extent we slow anything down, I think we move backwards.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
And then again, on this outside vendor contracting question, maybe for Mr. Bodern, on line 2.32, it says section 16C.09, paragraph A, clause 1, does not apply to these contracts. What is that?
Mr. Bodern?
What doesn't apply?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, that is, I can do it partly from memory, but basically anytime a state agency is about to enter a contract, it has to certify, or whoever's taking care of the contract has to certify there are no state employees capable of performing those same services. It's basically an efficiency clause.
I see.
And then, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Now we're going to lay this over, so I thought I'd give my little speech here. I'm not, Senator Jungbauer, I'm not, this is a good idea, I think, for the most part. But I think it's interesting that the first two bills on this theme that we heard the agencies step forward and said, yeah, we can put this tool in our toolbox. You know, we're kind of doing this already, but we can put this tool in our toolbox. This agency is saying something significantly different. They're saying we're doing this already. There's no evidence of a real problem, and we're doing a pretty good job of it. Do you have evidence of a problem or evidence that they're not doing all they can?
I'm hearing something different, Senator Dibble. What I thought I just heard, and maybe it should be clarified, that there's 2.5 FTEs, and they're doing a good job negotiating. I think part of this bill, as I understand it, looks at the space requirements as well. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took it that they're doing a good job negotiating, and a very good job. But as far as the space requirements, you don't have enough people to really get through all of it. Did I take you wrong, Mr. Waslowski?
Mr. Chair, you are, I would say it this way. We don't see the opportunity around issuing an RFP to have a commercial real estate firm negotiate our leases on behalf of the state. We don't see that as the opportunity. Where we see the opportunity is to hire an architectural interior design firm to redesign our spaces consistent with what we've seen, what Senator Jungbauer saw at Medtronic and what we saw at General Mills. That's where we see the opportunity. And so obviously we, as drafted, we do have concerns with.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, and again, kind of going back to the governor's idea that obviously his staff seen $12 million in lease savings, but I do see a bigger opportunity around space utilization and repurposing. But it very much, Senator Dibble, if there's nothing there for these folks to make money on, they're certainly not going to waste their time.
All right. And we
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add, we will have a fiscal note, and I know we weren't able to get it in today, but we will. There's obviously administrative work that goes into this process as well, so we'll try to get that in for the committee as soon as possible.
And I heard, Senator Jungbauer, you are going to work with Mr. Austin, the attorney for BOMA, as we
Yes, Mr. Forward. Chair, members.
All right. Certainly. Thank you very much. Senate File 798 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all. Final item on the agenda is Senate File 805. Senator Hand. And members, I know we have this space until 3 o'clock, and my intent is that we will take a vote by 3, and it will be laid over for inclusion. And I do understand we do have some testifiers, so Senator Hand, I'll let you proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for having me back in the committee. It's sort of like my second home these days. But my friend Ms. Alzweiger isn't here today. She usually is here testifying with me on things, but not today. Members, we have before you Senate File 805, and let me just acknowledge from the beginning that since this bill was introduced and has been out, I have been in consultation with people in the insurance world. I think there are some things that in the structure of what we're proposing that probably need to be tweaked, and it is my intention that if this is accepted as something that could be included in the bill, that we would continue to work on the structure to make it to address some of the things that have been raised. I think Senator Carlson has mentioned some things, and I'd invite him to talk about those at the appropriate time. But the thing I want to lay before the committee is this concept, this idea of looking at insurance for state employees in a little different way than we have, and offer a structure that we believe has some significant opportunity for cost savings, as well as, I believe, opportunity for potentially a better product. One of the things that we struggle with generally with healthcare is the idea of insurance and how to use that and how familiar people are with health insurance. What an HSA high deductible structure allows is the idea of true insurance, the idea of insuring high risk. And also along with that is the idea that there should be out-of-pocket expense borne by an individual. I talk to people about insurance and healthcare stuff all the time. You ask people, well, when you buy a car and you pay for a car and you buy car insurance and then you spend $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, who knows, out of your own pocket every year to buy gasoline, to buy oil, to buy tires, to buy windshield wipers, all the things that you do to maintain your car. And people say, well, that's just what it costs to have a car. You got to pay $3,000, $4,000 out of pocket every year to have a car. It's not covered by insurance. It's just things that we accept are part of out-of-pocket expenses. I think that the same idea ought to be in people's minds that when you think about ourselves and our health, there should be an accepted idea that there are out-of-pocket expenses that we should assume. And the virtue, I believe, of a structure that we're proposing today is it allows for those costs to be provided for in a way that allows people to be prudent and to accumulate savings, if you will, to be applied to those out-of-pocket expenses. So just generally, I want to walk through very quickly the structure of the bill. And as I said, we are looking at some things to, as this goes forward, to tweak some of that. But it would provide for that every employee, everybody who's an employee of the state, including the legislative branch, to have a health care savings account eligible high deductible health insurance plan with a $5,000 annual deductible. And it requires the in-network annual out-of-pocket maximum to be limited to $10,000. The employer required to make a $1,500 individual deposit, $2,500 family deposit into the health savings account. Plans cover in-network preventive care at 100%, cover the cost of care before the deductible with no further enrollee cost sharing, and all premium amounts to be paid by the employee. That is essentially what the bill does, and I would like to ask Mr. Tyler, who's a member of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, to provide some commentary on the structure that we're proposing. I think he's an expert in the field, and I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, does your committee have copies of this in your packet? If not, I would like to ask for
Senator
them to be
Senator Hand, we do not.
If you have a page that could distribute these to the members of the committee, or maybe I could ask Lee to do that. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Mr. Tyler to make up his presentation.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Tyler.
My name is John Tyler. I'm here as a representative of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters Legislative Committee and as a board member on the Minnesota Physician-Patient Alliance as well. I'm a principal owner of Boies & Tyler Financial Group, Inc. and HSA Health Savings Accounts, Inc., and have been involved in the design, implementation, and servicing of employee benefit plans since 1981. My companies insure over 200 group accounts and over 2,000 individual clients, most of which have health savings account plans. I was also very, very much involved during the 1990s in the actual design from a tax standpoint and in a deductible insurance standpoint of the HSA model itself. So that's something that, so healthcare reform is in part what the HSA is actually all about. Tax qualified HSA program is one that has been really very well received in the private marketplace on an individual basis, on a small, medium, large size employer community as well, both as an enhancement to their benefit plans overall, as well as a cost savings instrument to the employer and to the employee, both to the extent that they're paying, you know, both entities are paying for health insurance premiums overall. So the vast majority of our clients that are at our companies, all but two employers have high deductible health plans with HSAs. And I'd say about 95% of the individual policies that we have sold have HSAs as well by choice. They choose this instrument, you know, by choice. If members have the this particular flowchart illustration, I'll just touch conceptually on the HSA program and how it actually works. If everyone is looking at the tall box on the left hand side, this would be more of an indication of a current level of insurance coverage and a current level of premium cost on a per member per month basis. So it's more of a fixed cost, average insurance cost per member for a typical traditional type of a copay plan or a very low deductible plan that might have modest copays for prescriptions, modest copays for doctor's visits, perhaps 80-20, perhaps 90-10 coverage for inpatient services, and so on. So more of a traditional type of model overall. And every year these plans have specific out-of-pocket maximum expenses for individuals, for singles, as well as families. They might range anywhere from $1,500 a single to $2,000, $2,500 single per year. and two and sometimes three times that per family per year as well. And then every January 1st, they generally renew again, whether you've had those kind of out-of-pocket expenses. In the prior year, those out-of-pocket expenses recur in the next year. Those types of policies generally have very specific definitions of what is covered as far as the plans are concerned. So number two on the left-hand side there under traditional insurance plan, there's no means of refund to the employee or to the employer, generally speaking, if claims happen to be low. So premiums are paid, and there's no means of refund of premiums. As I mentioned before, these typically have out-of-pocket maximum liabilities that are defined, and provider access is usually determined by the networks of the plans that are chosen. And regretfully, these types of plans typically, that may not be true of the CBIC account, but it's typically have high premiums and climbing premiums as well each and every year, regretfully. It's become more and more of a challenge for these types of traditional plans to properly insure people. So these out-of-pocket liabilities just keep growing and growing every year. So having a $2,000, $2,500 per person out-of-pocket liability on these types of traditional plans is not unusual in the marketplace these days. And that's actually pretty true of the CGIP plan as well as the last time I saw it. The health savings account concept really combines a couple of instruments. It's really, instead of just a one-part insurance plan, we are creating a two-part insurance plan. We're using insurance to actually be more of a high deductible, a little bit further out of reach, catastrophic type of product. And so on the right-hand side of your illustration where it says, in the bottom right, it says high deductible health plan, by going to a plan that perhaps pays after a certain specified deductible, it might be $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 per person, per year. It might be 80-20, it might be 90-10, or oftentimes 100% after that deductible has been met. But by doing that, by going to a plan design like that, it reduces the premium cost on that type of plan, okay, from a traditional plan, sometimes by 30-40%, and even higher, depending upon what deductible is actually chosen, either by the employer or by the individual. And so the objective is not to just leave that as a standalone. The objective is, of course, is to create the funds through premium savings to fund the second part of the plan, which is crucial, because the health savings account was created by Congress and adopted by the state of Minnesota in 1997 as a tax-free account. It's an interest-bearing, tax-free, accumulating account from year to year. It has triple tax treatment, pre-tax going in from both the employer, pre-tax going in from the employee. Accumulating tax-free means it is interest-bearing, maybe invested in mutual funds if they so desire. So and when coming out for qualified health care expenses, comes out tax-free. So they've created a very, very special segment of the Internal Revenue Code, state and federal Internal Revenue Code, for the health savings account. And it creates a self-insurance mechanism for the individual consumer themselves. Both the employer and the employee may make contributions into the health savings account. Typically, these plans come with a significant employer contribution into the HSA account. Usually 50, 60, 75% of the deductible is not unusual per year to be funded by the employer. That's normal. Okay, if the employer isn't going to do that, don't do it. It's one of those types of things. We don't want just a standalone high deductible plan. We're talking about taking the premium savings generated by going to a less expensive major medical plan and funneling that or some portion thereof into the HSA account on behalf of the employee themselves on a tax-free basis. And so by doing that, we create a couple of things that are going on. First of all, the health savings account is not owned by the employer. It is owned by the patient. It is owned by the employee themselves. It becomes something that they actually may declare on their personal financial statement, like it was an IRA or a 401k. It creates a very special incentive for people to be very good prudent utilizers of their own healthcare expenses. It pays for prescription drugs, it pays for doctor's visits and those types of things, over-the-counter medications, eyeglasses, dental work, et cetera, on a first-dollar basis without copay. That's very important that we've replaced a traditional copay or deductible plan with a first-dollar benefit plan. So we now have claims being funded by two sources, one by the high-deductible plan, should they ever get there. Most employees never do. But more importantly, the HSA account on the lower level is designed to pay for health care claims and expenses as directed by the owner of the account, which is the individual. So we have a two-part plan, the most important of which is not the insurance component, but it is the HSA component themselves. So we have actually expanded the definition of qualified health care expenses from a traditional health insurance policy to a medical, dental, vision, chiropractic, over-the-counter medications, and so forth. And if it isn't used, it stays in the account and rolls into the following year to be used towards the following year's health care-related expenses. If those expenses are not used in the following year, they accumulate and roll into the third year fourth year, fifth year, sixth year, et cetera. It gives the employee a mechanism to eliminate, and this is very normal, this is not pie in the sky hyperbole, people really do, through their own contributions and through their employer's contributions, eliminate over time their future out-of-pocket health care expenses. What is magical and what is interesting about this is because the insurance policy itself suddenly is not a first-dollar payer with the exception of preventive care. It is only paying for claims after a certain threshold where of a chosen deductible usually has much, much, much improved health care utilization than if that same population had been part and stayed part of a copay type of plan, partly because the money in the HSA account is more efficiently administered than a typical traditional insurance plan. It just basically oftentimes costs a couple bucks a month in order to administer those plans. They earn interest, but they provide proper incentives for people to be very efficient and are with their own healthcare expenditures. What's beautiful about the HSA account is the money is there if it's needed, and it stays there if it's not. And that creates a very, very nice arrangement for the employee themselves. On the other side of it, for employee benefit plans, including the CGIP plan and any other that we're talking about, to be offered indefinitely, they have to maintain cost effectiveness. The HSA has really proven itself quite unique in the marketplace at providing traditional types of major medical insurance, meaning high deductible insurance, at a level to declining type of premium base. And that's not hyperbole at all. I think many of our clients do indeed have drastically decreasing premiums over time because their employees themselves are good stewards of their own health care expenses. It's also a retirement instrument as well, but I won't get too much into that. But the money accumulates and rolls into retirement to be used tax-free as long as the employee lives and maybe left to their surviving spouse as a tax-free operational health savings account program. So we have redefined the function of insurance to insurance basically to provide first dollar for the employee on through the HSA and insurance through a third-party mechanism as far as the insurance contract or policy is concerned. So the insurance is used primarily as a major medical policy to be used primarily if someone exceeds that deductible, which happens but not often. The HSA becomes the primary claims payer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, before we – could I –
Go ahead, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another point I wanted to make. There is not a fiscal note in your packet. I received a message that they're still working on the fiscal note precisely, but I do have at least an estimate that says there will be approximately $170 million in general fund saving over the biennium. I think Mr. Morocco may be here. He could offer probably a little more detail on that. But there is no fiscal note yet. It's being developed.
Is Mr. Morocco here? Still is.
Mr. Chair and members of the committees, you
could
know,
state your name for the record.
Sorry, my name is Nathan Morocco, Director of the Employee Insurance Division. Of course, I always hesitate to put a number out there. We are working on the fiscal note. I think Senator Hahn is approximation is good enough at this time. The challenge for the CGIP program is that we have more other funds coming into CGIP than we do actually have general funds, and so we're assessing what exactly that level is and also determining what the impact of the total legislation might be. But I think for now that would hold as a good approximation.
Thank you very much. Senator Kozelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And John, I can't see your last name, so sorry.
Tyler.
But I do have I want some clarification on HSAs in regards to when they reach retirement. I heard you talk about there are, I think, some real benefits if you've lived, chosen to live a healthy lifestyle and been relatively healthy, what you can do with those funds once they've built up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kozelka, absolutely. Absolutely they are. And what is nice about the HSA account as they are compared against traditional plans is they work very, very well as far as minimizing the individual out-of-pocket maximum liabilities if they're very sick, as well as if they're very healthy. Mm-hmm. And that's just really the magic of it. But really, the vast majority of individuals in our clientele, probably 85% or better, accumulate significant sums, and meaning sums that exceed their out-of-pocket maximum liabilities, from year to year. I have clients who have been first in the MSA, then the HSA as they morphed into it over time. Having $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in their account is not at all unusual over a period of perhaps 8, 9, 10 years. It just depends on how much they use the account. It is an asset that they own, and when they hit age 65, they may roll that into retirement, from which they may withdraw and make tax-free withdrawals for their qualified health care expenses really as long as they live. And so that's really quite a magical thing. Triple tax treatment is not available everywhere in the Internal Revenue Code, and it is designated for the HSA account.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is it also true that at age 65, you could take money that you've saved in the health savings account and go buy a car with it if you'd like?
Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, the game rules of the HSA account allow one to make withdrawals from the account really at any time to buy whatever they want to do. The pre-age 65 has a 20% federal tax penalty plus ordinary income taxes, and at age 65, the 20% tax penalty is waived and becomes like a regular IRA account. Is a taxable withdrawal from which they can buy their car, their boat, their whatever they want to do. It will always be in their best interest from a tax standpoint to leave it there and use it for health care, but to answer your question, yes.
Mr. Morocco, and then I have Senator Goodwin and Senator Daley and Dibble.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committees. If I could just make one comment. I did have an opportunity to talk to Senator Hahn, and that would be that essentially the bill, while much of the discussion here is around a high-deductible health plan with an accompanying HSA account, is that it largely does fix the liability on behalf of the state, and that fixed liability is channeled through a contribution to an HSA. While much of this discussion is about the actual design of the high-deductible health plan that accompanies it, that liability does not any that plan design nor the responsibility of the premiums or the impact of that plan design on the member really doesn't impact the state at all, because the way this language reads is that the premiums are paid 100% by the employee. So I would as I offered to the senator to work with him on perhaps not being as restrictive. I guess this is similar to my dependent audit testimony in that we may very well offer five different health plans, and that really should be indifferent to the state, whether it's a comprehensive plan, whether it's a high deductible plan, how we go about fixing that state's liability at $1,500 for singles and $2,500 for family. I think that's the key component, and that really is what is going to be the bottom line on the fiscal note. The bottom line of the fiscal note is really indifferent to the health plan that is offered the enrollees of CGIP. So I think while Mr. Boyd, I think presents some great information about how HSAs and high deductible health plans can work, I think for these purposes, it's really about what is the cost or what's the liability of the state going to be, and that really is all dependent on the fixed asset that we are going to give to the state employees, which is $1,500 for singles and $2,500 for family. The plan that wraps around that really should be indifferent, I think, from a policy perspective. And we would want, again, the flexibility, similar to what we do in another program, the public employee insurance program, where we offer multiple plans to local units of government, of which one is a high deductible health plan. And for those local units of government that want that option, they have that. But we also have a comprehensive plan, and we have some more midline product for those folks. So we would just want the flexibility to give the judicial branch, if they want a certain kind of benefit, the legislators a certain kind of benefit, the executive branch, or perhaps DNR wants something different from revenue, that we would have that kind of flexibility, and that wouldn't have any impact on the actual fiscal note that we produce.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hahn, when you started out, you talked about how cars and how we spend money on cars. You know, we're not talking about cars here. We're talking about people and their families. This is another bill that attacks Minnesota families, Minnesota working people. There's about 40,000 employees in the state and their dependents. Now, Mr. Tyler, you've got a lot to gain if this bill passes financially, your association and your individual company. You have a lot to gain, so I understand why you want this. But when you say that pays for prescription drugs and all these different things, that's out of the amount of money that's set aside in the health savings account. That's some kind of coverage they get for putting this money aside. That's basically their own money that they're paying for their drugs and so forth. The $5,000 deductible, I assume, is per family member. Per family member. The $5,000 deductible is per family member, correct?
Senator Hahn?
It's per family?
I believe that's the way I read it.
That doesn't specifically state.
Senator Goodwin?
But, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Hahn, 5,000, you know, I remember I was around in 1997 when this HSA is passed, and I know people that this is the only option they have on their job anymore because it's very cheap for employers to go into this plan. And it's basically no health insurance at all because they cannot afford $5,000 deductibles to pay, so they really can't get the health care they need. They just can't afford the deductibles. So here we are now. We're taking away or trying to take away employee health care. We've Senator Hanier bills have been 747 teacher termination and discharge.
Senator Goodwin on the bill. Senator Goodwin.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Already you overstepped your bounds when you used the adjective again today. It is not an attack, and I won't allow it. So we're on the bill, Senator Goodwin.
Okay, on the bill. It's one of a series, let's just say that, of taking away benefits and getting into the collective bargaining process in one way or another, weakening it. And I see the benefits to individual companies for this bill, but I do not see the benefits to either the healthcare system in general or specifically to the employees in the state of Minnesota. I think we could have it, Mr. Chair and Senator. Give it to us. Do it for the legislature, but don't do it for everybody else.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, I don't agree that this is treating anybody poorly. It's not. I think that high deductible HSA type insurance plans are the future. It is what we are going to all have to find a way to move to if we are going to afford health care. People talk about how can we have universal coverage, how can we all afford to have health care, how can we do these things when we know that that health care costs are rising, that the cost to do things go up. How do you insure against those costs? And the point I'm trying to make and the reason why this structure I'm proposing is one we should adopt is that it uses the concept of real insurance. What we have today is not insurance. What we have today is a commitment to pay bills. And when we say that we're going to write a blank check and say we're going to pay everybody's health care bills from dollar one, there is no possible way that we can live up to that promise. And everybody that's tried to do it has found out that after a certain amount of time, they run out of money because there's not enough people paying enough taxes to afford that kind of open-ended commitment. And so what happens is people think their bills get paid, and then what we find out is, well, we're not going to pay this bill, we're not going to pay that bill. Or we tell providers, well, we're not going to pay your costs, we're going to pay you 30% of your cost or 25% of your cost, and then maybe some of the providers decide they don't want to be in this business anymore because the number one payer is the government who's not paying for their costs. And that's, to me, you get into a death spiral. And how you recover from that, I don't know. We have got to find a way to solve our health care problem. We've got to find a way to use the tools that we have, and insurance is a powerful tool. And all I'm suggesting here is that we should take, as a state, leadership on this, and as a state, ask our employees to adopt a model that we think, that I believe, is the right way that we are going to have to adopt more broadly. But we as a state ought to try and do that and lead and provide a way for the state to say we're going to, as Mr. Tyler indicated, we are going to fix a cost by appropriation of what we're going to devote to the HSA structure. We're going to provide incentives for people to develop the accounts and find ways to take some ownership in their own health care. This is a real problem. Not only does this plan, in my opinion, make sense economically, but we talk all the time in our committee about how do you get people to recognize that they have an obligation to do things to take care of themselves. What are the incentives in the current structure that reward people for doing the right things and cause them to pay the price for not doing those right things? We don't have those today. What we tell people is live your life, do whatever you want. If you decide to eat certain things or you decide not to exercise or whatever it is you do and you end up with a long-term health problem when you're 60 years old, guess what? Somebody else is going to pay your bills for you. That's not right. That is not right. We have to somehow create incentives so people understand that what they do, there is a cost. In developing a plan where you have a vested interest, a financial interest in paying those bills, you can then create incentives that allow people to link, well, what I'm doing and what are the costs for those things and ask the question, do I want to live this way? Do I want to do those things? Can I afford to pay those prices? So we have got to find a way to reform health care in this state, in this country, that makes sense financially. It doesn't do any good to talk about how these things we're going to pay for everybody's health care when we know there is no possible financial way to accomplish that. That's dreamland. I think it is dishonest to tell people in the public that that's what we're going to do. This is real. This is something that does work financially. It can work. It is sustainable. It doesn't require unlimited amounts of taxpayers and taxes to make this work. And we have got to, I think, at least entertain it. And as I said in my opening remarks, Mr. Chairman, the particular structure that's in this bill, I think, is open to some discussion. I know there have been a few people in this committee and others outside the committee that have said that we may want to tweak some of this structure, and I'm perfectly open to do that. To me, the idea is we have got to adopt a structure in this state that makes sense, and we as a state employees, we ought to lead by showing this is what we think we need to do and do it. So that's my reason for bringing the bill, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and I know there's other senators that want to weigh in, but we do. I'm going to move forward, and you can because I know there's two other people for sure I have on my list that would like to testify. Mr. Stanton would be the first one, and then Mr. Kajewski, I would ask after that. So, Mr. Stanton, would you come up and give your testimony, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the faculty unions at the seven state universities. And I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate File 805. Senate File 805 shifts the cost of health care coverage off of the state employer and onto state employees. Currently, a premium for single coverage under the state health plan is $5,367 a year. The cost for family coverage is $15,784 a year. The employee pays 15% of the family of the dependent coverage. Under this bill, the employee would have to pay the full premium for health care, both single and dependent, reducing their pay after deductions, their comparable pay, by a comparable amount. Now, the bill does provide $1,500 if you have single coverage or $2,500 if you have family coverage to an HSA savings account. But that's only if, and that this is a big if, there's a state appropriation to cover that for the biennium. So the net shift, taking into account the amount that's put in your HSA account, would be about $3,867 onto the employee if they have single coverage, and about $11,721 onto the employee if they have family coverage. That's a huge pay cut and would have a devastating effect on our ability to recruit and retain quality faculty. Now, you know, I'm familiar with HSAs and HRAs. I've been the advocate for HRAs. We have an $808 HRA for our faculty that we negotiated, where if you don't use, if you watch your health care expenses, you don't use your expenses, you can save that money. It rolls into the next year, and we've even got a mechanism where it can be placed in your account, the healthcare savings plan account, in retirement. You don't need to require that employees pay 100% of the premium in order to have that mechanism, that tax advantage mechanism, available to them. You don't have to have a $5,000 deductible or a $10,000 out-of-pocket limit in order to get that. Mr. Chairman, members, we recruit nationwide at the state universities for faculty. And it's important that we have a compensation package that's competitive with public and private employers, private institutions nationally with whom we compete for faculty. There's a marketplace for faculty, and it's just like the marketplace for athletes or corporate executives. Those who pay the best compensation get first pick. Those who pay average compensation are hiring out of a market that's 50% picked over by better-paying employers, and those that pay significantly less than average end up hiring the people that the rest of the employers didn't want. Our faculty are not overpaid. Their average salary is slightly below average for comparable institutions, and their total compensation, including salary, health care, and retirement, is about average for all institutions and significantly below comparable private institutions. when we take into account the total compensation after the drop in compensation that would be caused by this bill, we'd be put in the position where we'd be hiring the dregs that are left over in the marketplace. That is not good for students. It's not good for employers. And I don't think it's what the parents of our students would want. We have been willing. We know what's motivating these types of cuts. We have a huge budget deficit in this state. But we also want to point out that we didn't cause that budget deficit. Our health care costs, you know, 2 years ago when the recession hit, we came forward. We said, suspend negotiations. We'll take a 2-year pay freeze. Our net compensation costs are zero for these last 2 years, the increase. The state health plan has had zero increases in premium for the employer for 2 years in a row. We do have mechanisms that encourage thoughtful use of your health care dollars. In fact, what they do is if you go to a low-cost clinic and sign up for a low-cost clinic, you get a smaller deductible and a smaller copay to encourage people to move to the more efficient clinics. If you take a low-cost drug versus a high-cost drug, you have an incentive to do that under the state health plan. If we go to this $5,000 deductible plan, it will ruin that plan. And quite frankly, you know, Governor Pawlenty has gone all over the nation saying that this is the way we should structure health care and pointing to the efficiency of our current health plan. Frankly, there's other ways, you know, to solve the budget crisis. You know, we believe we need to share the pain, but everybody should share the pain. And there's a lot of folks with high incomes that are paying a lot less taxes than they paid 10 years ago. The tax rates are a lot lower. And frankly, our belief is we're willing to do our share of share the pain, but others should also. Thank you.
I want to, folks, I will be laying this bill over and this discussion will continue, but I want to get Mr. Kajewski up here first. Isn't that? And also, I want to make sure we get in Mr. Bly, I believe, if he's, or whoever. I want to hear the testimonies. We will have plenty of discussion when this gets laid over, but I want to make sure that our testifiers get heard today, and we are up against a hard time limit here. So please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Richard Kajewski, Legislative Affairs Director for MAPE, and in my capacity I represent 13,000 of the state's professional non-supervisory employees. To be real quick, Mr. Chair, in respect of the time, MAPE does not support this legislation by any means. We support the right to collectively bargain for wages and benefits. This is part of that package. In recent short-term history, collective bargaining has made some changes to the health plan, including a health assessment, which was followed up by some counseling, a single pharmacy benefit manager, and a tier system that exists today to make that system more efficient. This really removes our right to collectively bargain for any of those pensions. This will result in nearly a 20% and up to about half of an average MAPE employee's salary being encumbered by paying for benefits. If you add that to, Mr. Chair, the recent bill that increases the pension cost for state employees in the general plan, the potential to lose 5% of the pay for performance bill that's up, the wage freeze, and even the 1 out of 6 jobs that would be cut through the 15% cut in the employees in state government by 2015. What we're really ending up with, Mr. Chair and members, and I think this is very serious, is we're ending up with about a $15,000 to $35,000 a year cut in a state professional employee's salary. These are employees' salaries that you're cutting who take care of your veterans in the veterans' homes. These are employees' salaries who provide the testing in the BCA labs, the health labs. They collect your revenues. They work in your colleges, as Mr. Stanton just said. And although I'm not here to question the intent of Senator Hahn, I've heard a lot of people around the table in this committee and a lot of people around the table in many other committees talk about what great work state employees do. I question what you're going to get working here in the state of Minnesota when that's the type of activity that's happening here. I don't believe this is what the public believes should happen to state government. And I think the numbers are going to speak for themselves, Mr. Chair, when that fiscal note comes out. This is not how the private sector treats their employees. And although there's arguments between the Chamber's report and the recent study that Mr. Side brought forward to the committee last week, and I can tell you, I did a bill 3 years ago, Mr. Chair and members, that showed the state's own Hay study, which is an international study, it's used more than just in the United States, and compares to the private sector and compares similar jobs and education and responsibility, that 70% of just the employees that I represent are underpaid in state government. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to leave it there for questions rather than get into personal feelings at this point. So
thank you, Mr.
Thank you for your time.
We're going to have our next testifier come forward. Again, I'm going to allow about 4 more minutes here. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We represent over 43,000 state, local, county employees throughout the state of Minnesota. One area that hasn't been pointed out, HSAs look pretty good to folks that are healthy, but they still take a risk. If you need any type of health care under an HSA, this is an additional burden for the employee, up to $10,000 for an annual deductible. Mr. Chairman, our members' average salary is $38,000 a year. Then we take a look at what happened earlier this week, a shift of 3% to the employee on the pension funds. Then we have the 15% reduction of workforce in the state of Minnesota, public employees, with another proposal. We have the 5% across the board cut. That's before we get to the division cuts that are coming before you yet this week. Public employees did not create the budget problem in Minnesota, and we'd ask that you not balance the budget deficit on the backs of public employees. Think about the reality, a $38,000 salary with the cuts that are coming before this body with the budget deficit and adding the burden of a $10,000 deductible plus the premium to public employees in the state. We oppose Senate File 805, and we would urge you not to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's going to be a lot of discussion coming forth. I'm looking forward to seeing the fiscal senator hand, and I appreciate the testifiers that have been here today. Senate File 805 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much for your time. Committee members, we will not have a meeting tonight. We will have a regularly scheduled meeting coming up Monday at 1 o'clock. You will, we will have the agenda out to you tomorrow of those bills that we will hear. No further business. This committee is adjourned.
It was a lot of money. Yeah.